We're about to share in another delight with one another. Satish Kumar is here with us, along with hosts along the back row there. Raise your hands so we welcome you as well to the final plenary of our Friends Association for Higher Education. One of the hosts, Bill, is American and couldn't believe to walk into Woodbrook and hear all of us. And when I was speaking with Satish about introducing, guess who we hold in common with him? Marjorie Sykes. I told you they would know her. And for those who don't, she was a dearly beloved friend who gave her life to service in India. And when he was 21 or 22, Satish met her, and they became very good friends. She translated many of the works of their common teacher, Vinoba. So a very deep connection. As he said, he is a friend of friends. I also want those who don't know him to hear a bit more about him, which I pulled from the Resurgence magazine website, so I assumed he had approved it. Born in India, Satish renounced the world and joined the wandering mendicant brotherhood of Jain monks when he was 9. Dissuaded from that path by an inner voice at the age of 18, he left the monastic order and became a campaigner for land reform, working to turn Gandhi's vision of renewed India and peaceful world into reality. Fired by the example of Bertrand Russell, he undertook an 8,000-mile peace pilgrimage to encourage nuclear disarmament in major urban centers, Moscow, Paris, London, and Washington. And only, of course, in America did he face a loaded gun. A mentor at the time of this march encouraged him and his companion to travel penniless and as a vegetarian. They did, and met in a tea factory outside Moscow two women who gave him and his companion 4 tea bags and said, "When you reach each of the city centers, give a tea bag and tell the right people if they think they want to press the button, stop and have a fresh cup of tea first." This journey is written about in his autobiography, No Destination. In 1973, he settled in England and became the editor of Resurgence magazine, which has been called by some the artistic and spiritual voice of the Green Movement. Still today, the editor of this influential magazine, he is the guiding spirit behind a number of ecological, spiritual, and educational ventures in Britain. He founded the Small School in Hartland, a pioneering secondary school, ages 11 to 16, which tells me he has wisdom, because he knows when we have to meet them, which brings into its curriculum ecological and spiritual values. And he is the director of program at Shoemaker College, a residential international center for the study of ecological and spiritual values. Following Indian tradition, in his 50th year, he undertook another pilgrimage. Again, carrying no money, he walked 2,000 miles to the holy places in Britain, Glastonbury, Canterbury, Lindisfarne, Iona, meeting old friends, making new ones along the way. This pilgrimage was a celebration of his love of life and nature. He has said that this reverence for nature needs to be at the heart of every political and social debate. He holds honorary degrees from the University of Plymouth, University of Lancaster, along with an international award from India for promoting Gandhian values abroad. His recent publications are here on the table, and there will be time for you to review them and buy them. He sees our global crises. Rather than blame, and in a recent blog, I think just a couple of weeks ago when you were at a nearby community building exercise, he wrote in his blog, rather than blaming and complaining or getting depressed at the prospect of doom and gloom, building community resilience and designing sustainable systems could be and should be a creative opportunity. We welcome your inspiration for us today. We are happy and willing to learn from you how to help partake in the creative opportunities you see for higher education.
Thank you. Thank you very much for such long and warm welcome. It is a great pleasure to come here. As you know, in this very room, Mahatma Gandhi spoke. And in this very building, Mahatma Gandhi stayed. And one of my another great mentor and hero, Rabindranath Tagore, visited here. He was a great mystic poet of India, Nobel Prize winning poet, but also a musician, painter, social reformer, activist. He was everything. He was a Renaissance man. So it's a very sacred place for me. So it's almost, I would say, coming here is a pilgrimage. And thank you for inviting me to address this wonderful audience. And many of you have come from the United States of America. And I was talking with Ben, and he was saying that some people are a bit concerned about traveling by plane. And I was saying that yes, that is a very right concern, because we all need to be concerned about our footprint on this planet Earth and the impact all our activities make on this earth, on the environment. But where do we begin when we want to reduce our impact on this earth? I would call coming to a conference like this, or going to visit your family or friends, I would call them love miles. But before we reduce our love miles, or while we are reducing our love miles, we need to reduce our food miles. Because a lot of food travels around the world unnecessarily. As I was coming here, I was talking with my friend and host Bill, and he was saying that they have allotment here where they have lots of apple trees, something like 70 apple trees. And England is one of the most wonderful apple growing country. We let our apples rot. We, not I, but our government will give orchard keepers subsidies to burn the apple orchards, while they are importing apples from South Africa, from New Zealand, from all sorts of places. Even something called Golden Delicious. They are not English apples. They are not golden, and they are not delicious. So we need to reduce our food. The way we produce our food, using vast amount of chemicals and fertilizers and fossil fuel, pesticide, herbicide. They're all fossil fuel based fertilizers. And the way we use machinery, the big, big combined harvesters and the tractors, if we can reduce our fossil fuel use in producing our food, the way we produce our food, the way we distribute our food, all these big, big lorries and trucks, refrigerated, going up and down the country, carrying bread, something called like Golden Delicious, mother's pride. Again, no mother, no pride. So, we need to change our way of producing food. It should be local, it should be fresh, and it should be lovingly produced. So, if before we reduce our love miles, let's reduce our food miles. Then, we should also reduce our military miles. The amount of fossil fuel used in the United States by Pentagon is colossal. If you divide roughly, somebody has done this, a rough count, roughly there are four main uses of energy. The military, the food, house and domestic heating and lighting, the way we heat our houses and so on, and transportation. These are the four main uses of fossil fuels. And almost nearly quarter of our fossil fuel, our petroleum, is used by the military in the world. And Pentagon is one of the biggest consumer of petroleum. So peace, which is a very favorite subject of the Quakers, I would say now, peace is not only something nice and good, and living peaceful is good, and good for people. Peace is an ecological imperative. It is an environmental necessity. Wars cause global warming. Now, ask Mr. Bush when you go back. I'm glad he's going. And we have to ask Mr. Obama, if he becomes president, that if you are serious about global warming and climate change, please declare yourself that you are going to be a peace president and not a war president. Because peace is a global necessity now for the environment. So we need to reduce our military miles. And we also need to reduce our heating and lighting use of fossil fuel. All these buildings which were built long time ago when oil was very cheap and coal was cheap, and we did not know that they are going to cause global warming. We did not know the problems of climate change. And so we built these wonderful windows, but very thin glasses. We have to double glaze them now. And we have to reduce our loss of energy. So, thank you for coming from the United States. Don't worry about love miles in the beginning. Now, I'm a friend of friends, and you are all Quakers and friends. First of all, I would like to pay tribute to the word friends. Because to me, the word friend is the most beautiful, the most spiritual word that can ever be imagined. When the Buddha was asked at his late life, when he was about to, what we call, reach nirvana or reach his enlightenment, or he had already was enlightened, but mahaparinirvan we call it, about to die, and his disciple asks him, and when you reincarnate, how would you like to come back? And he says, not as a teacher, not as a prophet, not as a philosopher, not as a king, but as Maitreya. And Maitreya means friend. I want to come back as a friend, not as a prophet, but as a friend. Maitreya. The Pali word for friendship is metta. Metta in Sanskrit is maitri. And so friendship is maitri, and friend is a mitra, mitra. So, and the one who reincarnates like a mitra becomes a maitreya. So these are the kind of language, linguistic. So Buddha put the word friendship at the top. Because all relationships in our world have something expectation inbuilt in those relationships. Parents expect something from children. Children expect something from parents. Husband expects something from wife. Wife expects something from husband. There's always a kind of desire, attachment, expectations are inbuilt in all other relationships. But friendship is purest of the pure relationship you can imagine. Because you do not expect anything. You are friend because you are a friend. There is no reason. You are friend not because somebody rich or poor or educated or uneducated or intelligent or less intelligent or black or white or man or woman. There are no distinctions. Friendship is the most unconditional relationship that you can imagine. And so, you are friends. Wonderful name you have for your organization. Now, until now, that word was used mainly to denote and to remember and to remind ourselves to be friends with the humans within your friends, Quaker Society of Friends, within that circle, friendship. Now, time has come when we need to extend that friendship. And extending that friendship goes not only that all humans are our friends, but whole of earth is our friend. Like you have your name, your society's name, the Society of Friends, Society of Quakers, the Society of Friends. There's an organization called Friends of the Earth, which is also a very beautiful name. Friends of the Earth. We are not the guardians of the earth. We are not the masters of the earth. We are not superior species upon this earth. We are not to think that somehow the earth is there for us. Our use. We can kill the animals, put them in factory farms, put them in poisonous conditions for our palate and our meat. And we can cut the rainforest so we can grow some more meat for our hamburgers and McDonald's. And we can pollute the rivers with our sewage. And we can do what we like to the oceans and sweep the fishing and for our wasteful use. We have to rethink about our relationship to the earth. And our relationship has to be that of friendship. And friendship is a relationship of equality. All friends, when you have a friend, you are equal. There's not superior or inferior. So, until now, the humanity has considered itself to be superior species. And all the other species are there to serve us. We got rid of slavery. We don't want anymore to have human slaves. But now, all the natural world is slaves of humans. And we use them as if they were our slaves. And this is the fundamental transformation of consciousness that is required. So if the Society of Friends can become the friends of the earth and whole of the earth and all the living beings upon this earth, humans and other than humans, they are our equal friends. American Indians had that idea. They considered all living beings as brothers and sisters and kith and kin. And St. Francis had that consciousness, and he talked to wolf and to the animals. And he called sun his brother and moon his sister. And so he embraced the earth. So we have a wonderful tradition. You, your ancestors, I would call them your ancestors in the United States, the native Indians. And our ancestors, like in Europe, St. Francis, we had that wisdom. And the Buddha had that wisdom. But in our last 200 years of industrial revolution, where we have been given this conditioning of our mind, thinking that somehow human beings are at the top of the pinnacle of evolution. We are the wonderful species, and all the earth is there to serve us. That idea now has to be challenged. And you can challenge it in your universities, the most importantly, because in the universities we are still pumping the old philosophy of anthropocentric worldview. Human beings, all everything for the human well-being. There cannot be human well-being if the earth is without well-being. If the earth community is suffering, the human community will suffer. Our biggest community is the earth community. And the human community is part of, an integral part of, that earth community. So we have to extend this feeling of the community, the friendship, the relationship. And when we extend that relationship to the earth, and if we can educate our young students in that worldview, a worldview which is not anthropocentric, but more biocentric or ecocentric, what we would call a deep ecology worldview, in which we accept the intrinsic value of all life, not just human life, but all life. And that's what Albert Schweitzer talked about, reverence for all life. If the Quakers can embrace that bigger idea, and if you as lecturers and professors and teachers in higher education, if you can bring that idea to your young students, because they are going to be the leaders of tomorrow, and they are going to be the presidents and prime ministers and CEOs and chief executives of the multinational corporations and business, if they start to think in terms of the integrity of the earth and integrity of nature, then these young people have some, there's a hope for the future, because these young people can transform the world. Because our generation, we have messed around a lot. Now it's perhaps the younger generation can do something better. So when we say a biocentric or an ecocentric worldview, what we are actually saying is there is no gap, there is no dualism, there is no separation between human beings and the natural world. Nature is not out there. The trees, the birds, the rivers, the gardens, the oceans, the mountains, the bees, the wasps, the birds, they are nature, we consider. We are humans, we are not nature. That must change. And we have to start thinking that we are nature. And if you go into the root of the word nature, you will realize what does it mean. The word nature is related to birth. When a woman is pregnant, she goes to a check, and that check is called prenatal check. Natal. The word natal and nature come from the same root. When you say American Indians are the native people, what does it mean, native? Native means those people who were born there. If you say I'm a British national, even nation word comes from the same root, because I am born in Britain, therefore I'm a British national. I'm born in India, therefore I'm an Indian national. So native, nation, natal, nativity, and nature, they all come from the same word. We are born. How can we deny that we are not nature? Nature out there, and we are here to rule over nature. We are nature. The moment we realize this unity of life, the moment we realize that we are nature and not separate from nature, we are related to nature, and all the living beings are our kith and kin and friends, then our worldview will change. And that compassion in our hearts will arise. So this is where we need to bring our educational system to rethink and reform educational system. Actually, I was very encouraged. Recently, I was in the United States. I was invited to be a visiting professor in Webster University in St. Louis, Missouri. And I met some of the professors there, and the dean and so on. And I was told that there are 300 universities in the United States who have signed a declaration that in next few years they are going to make a transition from fossil fuel based economy and a fossil fuel based system of running and organizing and managing the universities to a carbon neutral system of managing the universities. 300 universities, they are ahead of the game, ahead of Bush and Blair and even Mr. Brown, who is now, they're ahead of the game. So universities are actually leading, and I'm delighted to hear that. And if the professors and lecturers and teachers and students can take this great environmental cause of our time, that is a spiritual work. That is spiritual work. Environmentalism is not just a political work. It's not just an economic work. It's a spiritual work. To me, spirituality is not something separate from day-to-day living. Spirituality is not when you go to your Quaker meeting on Sunday morning and sit in silence, then you are spiritual, and rest of the time you are an economic animal or a political animal or a social animal. No, we are always spiritual. So every activity we do is our spirit, our consciousness, our motivation, our mind. Why we do something, if that is based in spirituality, then whether it's a gardening, or whether it's a cooking, or whether it is sitting in meditation and silence, or whether you are doing business, everything is transformed into spiritual activity. As in introduction, Rebecca said, I was a monk for 9 years. And at age 18, I read a book by Mahatma Gandhi. And Mahatma Gandhi said, there's no good some people renouncing the world and going and living in the monastic order and saying, world is too bad, too sinful, a trap. I want to be free and liberated from the world and escape into the monastic order. So the ordinary people will say, oh, spirituality is only for the saints. And Gandhi said, that dualism, that dichotomy between the world and the spirit has to be bridged. And we need to bring the practice of spirituality, practice of truth, practice of non-violence, practice of compassion and love into politics, into economics, into business, into domestic affairs, into everyday living. Spirituality in everyday living is true spirituality. Spirituality which is sort of boxed into a church or a mosque or a temple or a Quaker meeting house or some kind of religious little group, that needs to be liberated. We need to bring spirituality into every moment of our being. When I teach meditation, I say to my students that at the moment what we are doing, we are focusing, we are paying attention, we are being aware, we are being mindful. But why we are doing it? So that we could do every activity throughout the day, in everyday life, with mindfulness, with awareness, with attention, with spirit, so that all our activities are transformed into meditation. And there is no distinction between meditation and everyday living. Meditation becomes a way of life. In the same way, spirituality is a way of life. Non-violence is a way of life, how you live every day. And that is why the environmental work has to become a spiritual work. And that's where the Quaker tradition, and in higher educational field particularly, becomes very relevant. At the moment, most universities are not yet accepting the challenge of environmental concerns. Although, as I said, there are good signs that 300 universities have signed up the declaration. But if you look at the practice and the teaching, is still sort of business as usual. Our teaching has not much changed. We have not taken the challenge of our time. And therefore, I would like to say that spirituality should be at the core of environmental work. Why? Because if your environmentalism is driven by fear, which is at the moment mostly, fear-driven ecology, fear-driven environmentalism. Why you want to save fossil fuel? Why you don't want to use carbon? Because, oh, doom and gloom and disaster. That's a fear. World will come to an end. Oil is running out. What can I do? Oh, maybe I go to nuclear fuel. or biofuel or something else. That's all fear-driven environmentalism. Now, that's not a spiritual environmentalism. Spiritual ecology, reverential ecology, requires a different motivation for our environmentalism. And that motivation is motivation of love. When environmentalism is driven by love, power of love, and we say, I am environmentalist because I love this beautiful creation. I love the trees. I love the rivers. I love the oceans. I love the mountains. I love the land. I love the animals. I love humans. I love life. And that love will necessitate you will not be able to pollute the earth because you love it. If you love your neighbor's, your friend's house, you will not go and empty your trash bin into the living room of your friend, will you? Because you love your friends and you don't want to upset them. So in the same way, when our rubbish and our trash goes into the landfill, or our sewage goes into the river, or in the oceans, we have to think, that is the living room of creatures. How am I coming and going there and putting my sewage and my trash into the river and into the oceans and into the landfill? Because you love the land, therefore you take care of it. And that is the true Quaker and Christian and a spiritual Hindu, Buddhist, all our spirituality is same. Spirituality to me is like an ocean. Ocean of spirituality. And the religious traditions are like rivers. They emerge out of the ocean. The clouds come, bring the rain, form the rivers, and the rivers go back into the ocean. So we come from spirituality, we form our religious traditions according to our time, the communities are formed, the prophets are giving teachings in a particular language, in a particular time, in a particular context, in a particular need of the time, but then it goes back into the ocean of spirituality. So we are all in that mood and that consciousness. So in that consciousness, if our environmentalism is seen and understood, then I think we will be able to relate to the earth, and a sustainability will not be just sustainable development, sustainable business for a short time, but sustainability should be such a long term that we have to say that the earth will remain here for millions of years to come. It's not a 5 years, 10 years, 20 years program. It's not a 100 years program. It's what is going to happen in the next century. It's not like that. It's a millions of years to come. Because we are the future. We are the past. We are the universe. We are every human being is a microcosm of macrocosm. So we are the time and a space and a universe. And if we have that big vision, then we will behave and we will put our vibes and our behavior in such a way that every day we take care of each other. And we take care of the earth. And we take care of ourselves. Because we are the universe. There is no separation. This idea which René Descartes, the philosopher, French philosopher, come up with. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. That's a kind of separational worldview which has led us to where we are. And we have to now move on. And therefore, the title of my book I have put is, You Are, Therefore I Am. We exist in relationships. We don't exist in isolation. We don't exist in our heads just because we think, therefore I am. If food was not there, I will not be there. So earth is, therefore I am. Even the worms working under the soil play a very important role of keeping the land and the soil fertile. If the worms were not there, however big gardener you are, however great and green fingers you may have for your gardening, if the worms were not working under the soil, there would be no food, no vegetables, no fruit on your table. So long live the worms. So worms are, therefore we are. Bees are, therefore we are. If the bees were not there, there would be no pollination. At the moment in England, bees are under demise, and we are suffering. And if bees go, humanity will cannot survive, because without pollination. So life is so interconnected. How can René Descartes come and say, I think, therefore I am, and I'm in isolation, I'm a sort of individualistic, and I'm in my head. So his doubtful philosophy of doubt, we have to move from doubt to trust. And trust the universe, trust the process of life, and trust that we are taken care of. And therefore, no fear. Where my food is going to come from? Where my this, that, or the other going to come from? This doubtful mind that we have created our Western world. Trust. The universe is there for all of us to support. It is there. As Rebecca said, I went around the world without any money. 2.5 years. I walked 8,000 miles without any money. Walking. I tell you the story of how I discovered America before I finish. I was walking from India. I started from the grave of Mahatma Gandhi, and I walked through India, and then coming to Pakistan. And between Pakistan and Afghanistan, there's a wonderful high pass called Khyber Pass, very high. So I was walking up and up and up and up and up like that. A tiny road, and a car came by and passed by, then stopped and reversed and said, do you want a lift? I said, no thank you, we are walking. So the person said, aren't you glad in this wild Khyber Pass somebody's offering you a lift? I drove for you out of my compassion back, reverse my car, to offer you a lift. Where are you walking to? I said, as a matter of fact, we are walking to the United States of America. So the man was very puzzled. He came out of the car, and I remember he stood like this and said, gentlemen, do you know where the United States of America is? I said, sir, we have never been there, but we believe that America exists. And we want to find out, we want to discover. Every time, we don't have to be Columbus to discover America. I can discover America, I want to find out if you exist. The person was from the United States. So he said, all right, I don't believe you will make to America walking like this, but if you do, here's my card. Please give me a call. All right, sir. When you have no money, a card is very useful. An address for a cup of tea. So he went. And so I kept the card, and we were two of us. We walked through Afghanistan, through Iran, through Russia, Moscow, Belarus, Poland, Germany, Belgium, France. We came over the channel with the friend, support from some peace-loving friends and Quakers in Paris. There's a beautiful Quaker house in Paris, and we were welcomed there. If you are a peace person, you can go to any Quaker house, you'll be welcomed. So we always were welcomed in Quaker houses. And we crossed the channel, we came to Dover, we walked, and we met Bertrand Russell, and he helped us to cross the Atlantic with the two tickets in a Queen Mary boat. We crossed the Atlantic, we came to New York, we were received by A.J. Musté. Anybody heard of A.J. Musté? Yes, A.J. Musté was our host in New York. And then we walked from New York, and as we were walking, I was always looking for the card. The address of this person, the man was called Dr. Scarf, and his address was in Philadelphia. So as we were walking, came to Philadelphia, I phoned, Dr. Scarf, do you remember two Indians you met in Khyber Pass? He said, yes, I do. Where are they? I said, we are right here in your town. We have made it after 2.5 years. We made it. He was amazed. And he came, he met us, he invited us to his house. We stayed with him for the night, and he invited friends and gave us big dinner. And he said, I could have never believed that you could walk to America like this without money and vegetarian. And then, because people think that if you are vegetarian, you don't have energy. And I'm 72 years old, and I have no lack of energy. And I'm vegetarian, not in my life, my ancestors. For 1600 years, my family has been vegetarian. So if you think that vegetarians cannot survive and cannot have good health, that's a myth. Because the agribusiness who want to promote meat, they always tell you that you need so much protein, so much this, so much that. You don't need so much. You need very little. So, and if you want to see energy, horsepower is always measured in horsepower. And horses are vegetarians. So, no problem. So, the vegetarianism is also an ecological message, not just an idea of some Jains or Buddhists or somebody who are kind of practicing restraint and poverty, voluntary simplicity and all that. It's an ecological necessity. If we talk about the population of the world, 6 billion people, and if you see all those 6 billion people eating the amount and the kind of meat which Europeans and Americans and the rich people eat, if 6 billion people have those cattle and pigs and chickens and all the kind of meat that we need, what will be the world population? And they're all fed by grain. Instead of feeding people with grain, you feed cattle with grain. So, what is the population? And so, if we want to really make a smaller footprint on this earth, a smaller environmental impact on this earth, and live in such a way, in harmony with the natural world, then we need to reduce our meat. And if we do eat meat, it must be organic, it must be free range, and the animals should live happily, grazing nicely in beautiful pasture, not grain fed. My mother had 2 cows. We were vegetarians, but we had milk. And the cows were fed by grass and never any grain. And you have a small amount of milk, that's enough. You don't need much milk. You only need a little. So that kind of vegetarianism and that kind of reduction in meat, that would be another ecological necessity for our time. So friends, I have said a few words to bring the ecological environmental dimension, which is my passion at the moment, and I feel that this environmentalism is very pertinent issue for the Quakers. Pertinent issue for all of us, but particularly for the Quakers, because your philosophy and your vision and your society is so much in tune with the integrity of the earth. And you are friends, and therefore being friends of the earth will be no problem for you. So I brought this message of environmentalism, and particularly to you, because if we start this message in the universities and put environmental thinking and studies and how we live, when I was in Webster for 2 months, I was teaching there, I started with my students, I said, we are all going to start a garden. Not just intellectual lectures and teaching. We'll do some hands-on garden, organic garden, compost making. It was a wonderful experience. Students loved it. And I said, we will have a class of cooking. So, growing, cooking, then we know where our food is coming from. Reducing food miles. And my students were very happy. So thank you very much for letting me speak to you and inviting me. Thank you. Thank you. Maybe a few questions. Yes, please.
I work at a Quaker college, and we've been blessed recently with the receipt of a $1.5 million grant to hire faculty in the area of environmental studies. My particular center, along with others, have been asked to coordinate a process by which we can invite people who are so-called experts in this field to come to our campus to advise us on how to build this new environmental studies program. And I'd like to ask for your thoughts on what advice can you offer our college as we begin the path of creating a brand new program that we've never had before in environmental studies. And be mindful of the fact that we're going to invite a humanist, a scientist, and a public policy expert to come as part of this process because we feel that we need to engage all of the disciplines in this.
Wonderful. You have a great opportunity there. My advice to you would be that means and ends must coincide. It's no good just visualizing and creating an intellectual, utopian, environmental, sustainable future. We have to start where we are now. So bring your environmental studies and see how everything we do in the university can be done in an environmentally friendly way. Can university grow some of its food? Can university students and teachers participate in the cooking of the food, which is less energy intensive? Can we do organic gardening? Can we do all the things which we live, the way we live, the way our university is run, should be an example of environmental studies? So study is not just in the books or libraries or videos or computer programs or lectures. They are fine, they are necessary, but they are complementary to actual practice. So that would be my advice, that begin by looking at your university and how your things are, buildings you are building, how you are building it, any purchase you are making, how you are purchasing it, where your food is coming from, where your glass is coming from, where your paper is coming from, where your furniture is coming from, how it is made, is it sustainably made, all those issues. If you can put a small committee of people using that money who will audit the ecological footprint of the university in which you are working and how much footprint you can make smaller and reduce it and make it beautiful, useful, but durable. These are the three words I would ask you to remember. Beautiful, useful, and durable. Everything in the university should be beautiful. In nature, so much beauty. In our university, we build ugly buildings, ugly furniture, mass-produced, factory-made. Give craftspeople some work to make things beautiful. They should also be useful. Because it's no good just having some decoration of beauty and then everything useful is factory made. And it must be durable, made to last, not just change every 5 years. But something with old furniture, older it gets, better it is, more valuable it is. So BUD, what I call the BUD principle. BUD, beautiful, useful, durable. If you can audit your university and bring your experts to look at the way university functions and how you can make it more efficient, more renewable energy based, all that practice, then your study and your lecturing have an integrity, have more power. Words without practice have no power. Education should have the three dimensions, intellectual, spiritual, and physical. At the moment our universities are too much intellectual. Very little spiritual and almost nothing physical. Only thing we teach our students to learn with hand is to use computers. Nothing else. These hands are wonderful. They can build, they can grow, they can make. We are makers, not consumers. So if you can bring those things to your university, I think you will be leader in your country. Yes, please.
One objection to vegetarianism is that we don't want to eat meat, people say, because we love the animals, and animals have consciousness. But we also might believe that plants have consciousness. But we have to eat plants also. So therefore, let's eat meat too. How do you respond to that argument? That plants have consciousness?
Yeah, yeah. plants have consciousness. Therefore, we can eat them. And since we can eat plants, we can eat animals because they have consciousness. Since we eat animals, we can eat humans because they have consciousness. So you can be, what is the word called which you use?
Animals.
Humans?
Huh? Animals.
Cannibal. Cannibal. You can be cannibal. Or you can say, since we have pigs, and we eat pigs and cows, we can eat horses as well. Okay, we eat horses. Okay, we can also eat elephants. We can eat also eat dogs. We can also eat cats. No limit, no restraint. We all, freedom is only possible within limits. So you have to make limits. So you have to say, I'm not going to eat humans. I'm not going to eat horses. I'm not going to eat dogs. I'm not going to eat cats. I'm not going to eat red meat. I'm only going to have maybe fish. I'm not going to have fish even. I may have a chicken occasionally. I will have maybe once a week. Reduce, limit. Even there are people who are vegans. They say, I'll not even have milk and eggs, and I will not have even cheese. Vegans. There are people who are fruitarians. They say, I'll have only fruit. So you can make your limit. The question is how you move in that direction. And when you have a limit, then you appreciate whatever you are eating in a different way than anything goes. You have no consciousness. There's whatever comes you eat. When you are aware what you are going to eat, what you are going to wear, what kind of clothes you are going to wear, what kind of house you are going to... You have to read my book called Spiritual Compass. There are three ways. I have three qualities. Every house, you can say, I live in a nice, simple, beautiful house, like a minimalist house. Or you can live in a palatial house, very energy consumptive. Or you can live in a high-rise building. So you have to make a decision. And what we in India, we say, sattvic living, means living which is close to nature, which is simple but beautiful, simple but elegant. At the moment, what is missing in our industrial world is elegance. If there's no limit and no restraint, then there was no elegance. But the moment you bring Zen simplicity, I mean, look at the Zen art. Simplicity, Zen buildings. I was in St. Louis, as I said, there is a Japanese Zen architect called Endo, and he has built this beautiful, very simple, very elegant art gallery for the Pulitzer family, Pulitzer art gallery, because Pulitzer family come from St. Louis. So that simplicity, that restraint gives you freedom. It is blessing to be a simple person, and it's blessing to have a restraint. Restraint is the key to vegetarianism. Yes, there was a question there. Yes, please.
I enjoy your talk a lot, in part because I hear you saying a couple of things to me, which is, first you're saying you must get rid of this anthropocentrism of yours.
Yeah.
But you also seem to be saying that if all I can manage to do is to ditch the golden delicious apples, you will still love me. And so I'm finding that helpful because I hear in both of your talk an absolutism and also an incrementalism.
Yeah.
And I think that's important because when I thought about your saying that environmentalism has to be a part of a spiritual discipline, a spiritual exercise, and therefore for environmentalism to happen, truly happen in our institutions of higher education, you're saying that's crucial.
Mm.
Our institutions of higher education have to adopt this spiritual view.
Mm.
Well, many of us come from a place where that's a difficult challenge, even Quaker colleges, because there is, I wouldn't say exactly warfare, but there is dispute. There are some folks who would say that the life of the intellect, the life of the academy, is incompatible with religion, if not with spirit. So I'd appreciate some reflections on how to practice this notion of ultimately, the goal being ultimately to have a spiritual basis for all, but a recognition that as we go back to our home institutions, we have colleagues who are scarred by the fear that spirit religion means that they will be oppressed into a particular practice that is not their own.
Yeah.
You see where I'm headed?
Yeah. First of all, what oppresses is not spiritual. Spiritual brings freedom, what we call free spirit. So we have to start with that. And then we have to say that, like I said, pragmatism and absolutism or vision, they complement. There is no good just vision wonderful vision and no pragmatism, no incrementalism, then it's no good. So pragmatism and idealism, realism and idealism must complement. You are a pure idealist, not enough. If you are pure pragmatist and realist, not enough. Realism, idealism should marry together. We have realists, and they have made the mess of the world. And we have idealists, and they have not brought any great difference to the world either. So we need to bring these two together, idealist and pragmatist, or idealist and realist. So the idea of what I'm talking would lead to, in the way of thinking, that there are no opposites. All opposites complement. There are no contradiction in opposites. So dark and light complement. Left and right and left complement. So male, female complement. Above, below complement. So if you can take this idea to your colleagues and say, this idea, there's a tension between running an intellectual institution of an academy or a university and bringing spirit into it is a tension. So either you have a spirit or you have intellectual inquiry. This idea of tension and conflict has to be resolved. And we have to bring how intellect and spirit can be married together. Science and spirit have to be married together. Without spirit, science leads to nuclear weapons and genetic engineering. Without science, rational thinking, inquiring mind, religion leads to, or spirituality leads to, fundamentalism. Christian fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism, Muslim fundamentalism, any kind of fundamentalism. So you need rational thinking in religion and spirituality. So you need intellect. But without moral compass, without spiritual compass, without some vision and the principles, if you have just intellectual, pragmatic institution, that will lead to a commercial kind of rat race type of university. And you will always sort of be in a tension. So in order to make a university, intellectual place, a happy place, where you enjoy teaching, where students come and enjoy learning, and the atmosphere is booming and wonderful and exuberant, then you need to bring spirituality and pragmatism together. This separation, this I think therefore I am, this dualism, Cartesian dualism, mind and matter separate, spirit and matter separate, intellect and spirit separate, that separation has to be bridged. And we have to bring science and spirituality together, intellect and spirituality together, matter and spirit together. Our body is the example. Our body is matter and spirit together. We are not separate. Mind is not something else, and heart is not somewhere else. It's in one body. If we can live heart and mind and feeling and emotions and intellect, everything in one body, why can't we have one body of the university in the same way? So it's a kind of complementarity of the two. Okay. Yes, please.
For me, one of the most difficult areas of environmental activism is making choices between the needs of very poor human beings,
yeah,
and natural environments and beings. If I'm faced with the unfortunate choice of having to choose between killing a dog or killing a human baby, I will surely choose to kill the dog rather than the baby. So I have a certain anthropocentrism built into the way I evaluate things. If you establish a nature preserve in India, but in setting up the limits of that preserve, you deny to native people in that area access to food sources, and they are very poor, and their survival depends, you see kind of where this question comes. So the hardest choices for me come from questions of justice for human beings who are in third world environments and are very deprived, and how we preserve and feed and take care of those persons,
yeah,
while preserving natural.
Yeah, very good question, very important question, because as I was talking about the tension between intellect and spirit, there's a tension between environment and development. Tension between environment. Do we preserve environment before we have development of people? And the answer is similar. I don't feel a contradiction between environment and development. if environment damages or underrates or undervalues or undermines the livelihood of human beings, then that's not good housekeeping. That's not good environmentalism. And if human beings are given such a priority that environment is damaged, then you are cutting the branch upon which you are sitting. Humanity cannot survive and cannot have justice and cannot have well-being and cannot feed itself if the environment is destroyed. So this dichotomy is absolutely false dichotomy to make this tension between humans and nature, either well-being of humans or well-being of nature. I want to create a vision where human well-being and earth well-being are two sides of the same coin. They are totally integrated. And the problem at the moment of justice is not because poor are putting pressure on the environment. It's not poor. It's the rich, us, in the developed world, Europe, America, Japan, Australia. We are putting pressure on the environment, not the poor. Poor are the protectors of the environment. I come from the poor countries and poor parts of the world. The native people are the protectors of the environment. It's the industrialist mind which goes with bulldozers and chainsaws and all these industrial, heavy, fast machines to destroy the environment. Poor people use hands. How many trees can you cut with your hands and with the chains? I mean, hand saw. But bulldozer and a chainsaw will destroy the rainforest. So it's not the poor. The justice is at the moment in favor of the rich and the powerful. So we have to start thinking, if we lived like the poor, if we lived like the Indian American, American Indians, native people, if we lived like people live in small villages and rural areas where there are small footprint and small impact on the earth, they take care of the earth because without, that's their livelihood. If the trees are not there, the forests are not there, the land is not good, the animals are not good, their livelihood is gone. But our livelihood does not depend on the environment. We think. We have this illusion or this kind of mythology that we don't need nature. What we need? Money. That's what we need. This is complete illusion. Money does not keep us going. Because we have built a system where money is keeping everybody going. But that is not the truth. The real truth is the trees and the land and the animals and the rivers and the clean air, the clean water, they are keeping us going. And the poor look after them. So poverty is not the problem. The way you Christians and Quakers will understand the word poverty in Christian tradition, when a monk took a monkhood, a Christian person took a monkhood, they take a vow of poverty, chastity, obedience. What is that word poverty means? Poverty is a very pious, very beautiful word. St. Francis embraced poverty, Lady Poverty. So poverty word has been denigrated, demoted, and we have put the meaning, some kind of wrong meaning in it and say, oh, poverty means starvation, hunger, deprivation, something. No, no, no. Blessed are the poor. So justice is not in the favor of poor at the moment, it's in the favor of the rich. So social justice and ecological justice are together. If there's no earth jurisprudence, there cannot be human jurisprudence. So this is why I say we are nature. We are kith and kin of every living being. And therefore, we have to find a way for... The challenge is more for the developed and the industrialized and the very rich societies. So how we reduce our impact and our footprint on this earth and live without creating waste. That's all we need to do. Only thing we have to do, nothing else, there's no complicated message here. The American society is the greatest waste-making society. The European society is second. Japanese come after that. We are creating so much waste. In nature, there's no waste. We create so much waste. If we can eliminate waste, then there'll be no poor and no rich. There'll be all humans living frugally, simply, beautifully, in celebration of nature, and a celebration of the earth, and celebration of humanity, and celebration of the spirit, in friendship, in creativity, in poetry, music, dance, painting, architecture, beauty, everything. It's just this greed and waste we have to reduce. Simple, very simple. So I'm all in favor of human justice. I'm all in favor of giving right to the poor so they can live well on the land, with the forest, or by the river, fishing. All their rights should be protected. But rights of humans have to be balanced with the rights of nature. If nature has no rights, and just humans have rights, that right is half right. So rights of nature and rights of human complement each other. They are not in contradiction. So environment and development are together. They are friends, not enemies. Maybe one more question, last one. Yes.
Sorry, people, last question. I really appreciated your concept of the love miles that you opened the talk with. And 2 years ago, I was asked to be the environmental, I guess the sustainability czar of my university, and it's been wonderful work, and it's been tough, as David pointed out, most of us probably have experienced that, but early on I had a mentor who works at a similar kind of university, Dudley Greeley, who I just got in contact with, and he taught me really early on, he says, remember, more fun, less stuff. And I remember calling him up at one point where I was being, you know, I had to give an answer, you know, yesterday on a recycling contract, and I called him up panicked because I was out of my depth, and he just emailed back, and he said, Abigail, breathe, tell them you will have the answer tomorrow. It's not fair of them to ask you to have it in an hour.
Yeah.
And that kind of keeping ourselves sustainable.
Yes, exactly.
Is so important. And the love base, you know, we all can hold up when we're moving towards fear than out of love. One of the examples for love miles I wanted to bring up was there's a tension in our university, maybe in others, between security and the rest of the university. So after 9/11, and after what happened at Virginia Tech, you know, security is getting more and more money. And so the police became the target of some of the people, and you know, they sit there and they idle in their huge, powerful cars, blah, 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 blah. So I called up Dudley, and he said, don't go after the police. You know, and it was an example of love miles. He said, recruit them.
Yeah.
They want to be part of this, but don't go after their cars.
Yeah.
And he was right, and I've now got them turning all the lights off in the university, which I want to say isn't part of their contract. I don't know if they're doing it out of love or what, but anyway, they're doing it. I just wanted to, I would love some more examples of, you've given many examples of fear traps.
Yeah.
And, you know, every time this time comes and shows the light to me again, to either my friend at the University of Southern Maine or you, it's just so, it's so simple. It's like, here it is. And I would just love some more examples of love miles. Just about priorities, but love miles.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, if you are, as you said, not sustaining yourself, if you are not sustainable, if your life is not sustainable, then how can you make the earth sustainable? And going and visiting your friends, going and visiting your family, going and taking a course somewhere, being with your colleagues, learning something in your life, those are all love miles. And so using certain amount of energy frugally, carefully, mindlessly, but with mindfully, then we have to give priorities. And we say, we reduce military miles, we reduce food miles, we reduce our heating bills, and then also be mindful of traveling. And not so food miles, traveling is very big. So I think that needs to be reduced. And then visiting your friends and family, and that should be not so much attacked. So that's a kind of self-sustaining, self-nurturing. If you are not well, you cannot make anybody else well. If you are not happy, you cannot make somebody else happy. And being happy is different from pursuit of happiness. I say to my American friends that you have been pursuing happiness for 500 years. Now try to be happy, not pursuit of happiness. So I mean by sustaining yourself is a very important aspect of environmental work. So thank you very much. I'm leaving a little bit of time because if you would like to look at some of my books, and also as Rebecca said, We have been publishing this magazine, Resurgence, for the last 42 years, when environmental ideas were very, very minority concern. And so this is a magazine which has a kind of ecological, spiritual, artistic sort of ethos. So if you want to look at that and some of my books, if you want me to autograph my book, I'll be happy to do that. But in the end, I would like to thank you for giving me this chance to speak to you, and thank you, Ben, and other organizers. Thank you, Rebecca, and thank you, this wonderful place, for having me here. Thank you.